Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Finance Forward. Mein Name ist Niklas Wilminghaus und ich freue mich, dass ich nach den langen Wochen, die hier vor allem der Kollege Kaspar Schlenk bestritten hat, auch mal wieder vors Mikro darf. Kaspar hat auch in den tiefsten Corona-Shutdown-Zeiten Gast um Gast hier im Podcast befragt. Dafür auch an dieser Stelle noch einmal herzlichen Dank. Das größte Thema dieses Fintech-Sommers ist zweifelsohne der Fall des vermeintlichen Payment-Wunders Wirecard. Und wir beschäftigen uns heute noch einmal mit dem Skandal und mit einer Frau, die längst nicht als erste, aber eben viel früher als viele andere erkannte, dass das Unternehmen nicht das war, für das wir es hielten. Ihr Name ist Fahmi Kadir. Die 29-jährige Amerikanerin wurde vor 5 Jahren bekannt, weil sie für einen großen Hedgefonds erfolgreich Leerverkäufe gegen das umstrittene Pharmaunternehmen Valeant steuerte und dafür in einer Netflix-Serie prominent porträtiert wurde. Später machte sie sich mit ihrem eigenen Fonds selbstständig. Dort setzt sie ausschließlich auf sogenannte Short-Strategien. Das heißt, sie wettet auf fallende Kurse börsennotierter Unternehmen und sie versucht dafür vor allem jene ausfindig zu machen, die in dubiose Geschäfte verwickelt sein könnten. Wie sie auf Wirecard aufmerksam wurde, wie sie versuchte, hinter die Geheimnisse dieses undurchschaubaren Unternehmens zu kommen und wie sie schlussendlich den Zusammenbruch erlebte, das erzählt sie im Gespräch, das wir logischerweise auf Englisch geführt haben. Viel Spaß! Fahmi, it's great to have you on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You initially started shorting Wirecard in the beginning of 2018. At that time, Wirecard was a fast-growing payment venture, but not even in the DAX. How did you become aware of that company?
Yeah, so Wirecard was actually one of the first short positions we put on. We launched SoftKit in January of 2018. And we had a sizable position in Wirecard, but not nearly as large as it was this past year. Wirecard came onto my radar in the fall of 2017 as I was building out the pipeline of short ideas for SoftKit. And the reason we were interested in Wirecard was because it checked a lot of the boxes we like to see as far as there being over a decade of very solid reporting on various allegations and suspicions within the company relating to money laundering and other forms of criminal activity. So somehow over the course of that time, Wirecard was very successfully able to evade that criticism and never really provide answers to the questions raised. So it seemed like it made sense for a fresh pair of eyes to take a look at the situation, how it may have changed, and how we could approach it differently than others had in the past.
You had like a long list of companies that you would look at and that would make for potential short targets?
So this is one of the sorts of ideas, targets that were previously investigated by journalists and short sellers, where those accusations may not have stuck to the company. So quite a few of the positions we've taken on over time fit that bill. But again, it's only just one source of ideas.
For you, what was the like the main red flag? What made you suspicious?
Well, whenever the business model doesn't really make sense, as far as how does it compare to others operating in the similar industry? Because Wirecard wasn't a traditional payment processor by any means. I think the German people were well aware of this, that it was largely focused on high-risk merchants. So merchants within pornography, adult entertainment, gambling, binary options, etc. Rather unsavory businesses with a lot of regulatory hurdles, where most payment processors will try to reduce their exposure because there's a much higher risk of chargebacks. And by chargebacks, I mean instances where a consumer will say, I didn't make that transaction, so give me my money back. Typically, what is a fatal risk for a payment processing business is overexposure to high risk. So generally, the payment processors that focus on this space tend to be smaller in size because they're limited in scale, because you can't keep growing your ability to process for these types of industries. Meanwhile, Wirecard became a 20 billion euro company. And it wasn't clear to us how they did that. It certainly wasn't through a rapid expansion of legitimate business. So we wanted to understand why, because when things so basic don't add up, it's very likely that there's something untoward happening within the company.
And how do you proceed from there? What are like techniques that you'd use?
Well, with this, we first had to recreate the understanding that people had within Wirecard. Obviously, it's a very complex business, and that was by design. Over really since 2010, when Jan Marsalek took over the reins as COO, the company engaged in a rapid growth acquisition strategy where it was acquiring businesses all over the world. It already had a banking license, but now it was acquiring various prepaid card businesses all over, you know, through various geographies. And whenever you're engaging in that sort of growth strategy, it becomes a lot more difficult to understand what is the underlying business actually doing. And while it was rapidly expanding, it also changed its corporate structure in a way that much of its business was then flowing through black box jurisdictions like Dubai and Ireland, where it's much more difficult to, again, understand what's going on at the consolidated company level. So we just started by recreating all of that and understanding from the bottom up what was happening within Wirecard. But more importantly, once we got to that point, we wanted to understand what has changed. Part of the hurdle for journalists and those critics of the company has always been the German financial establishment and regulatory establishment, their unwillingness to pursue claims against Wirecard. So we thought we have to find another angle here. And one of the last acquisitions that Wirecard had made was of Citi's North American prepaid card, which then gave them a U.S. headquarters, put them very clearly in the jurisdiction of the U.S. So we approached Wirecard with the hat of a U.S. prosecutor, essentially, to understand and collect evidence of whatever U.S. laws, rules, regulations Wirecard may be breaking.
How did this work exactly? Like, how do you approach a company with someone like that?
Well, one of the first things we did was actually go to Wirecard's North American headquarters in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. So we drove there. It was a very large building, but very few employees inside. It's not exactly the place where they're expecting investors to come. Of course, they don't really expect American investors, given it's largely, you know, you have a German investor base. So we showed up and just tried to learn more about the prepaid card business. The North American employees don't necessarily get a script from Germany about what to say when investors come. So they're much more transparent about the business that they're doing. So, you know, just this said, I'm an investor. I'm interested in these prepaid cards. Let's talk about them. And the information that we learned from those discussions with sales executives within the North American business made it clear that there was something funny happening, in that the prepaid card that they could provide could be up to $100,000 in value. I'm not sure how much you know about prepaid cards, but they're generally used for, you know, gift cards or rebates, rewards programs. So very small dollar amounts, you know, maybe a couple hundred dollars, certainly not even, you know, a couple thousand, but for it to be $100,000, that was a huge red flag. So then, you know, taking these bits of information, how do we place these pieces of evidence in the broader context of the business Wirecard is conducting? Why would they possibly need such high dollar value prepaid cards? And more simply, why were they so systematically acquiring prepaid card businesses over the, you know, course of the past 10 years in all of these different jurisdictions?
And what did you make of it?
So going back to what I said about chargebacks being a fatal risk for payment processors, one way around this is chargeback dilution through what some in the industry may refer to as friendly transactions or friendlies. And the way this works is that you can use prepaid cards or, you know, any card really to transact between related parties, which will effectively inflate the number of transactions that are occurring. But these are essentially legitimate transactions in the sense that you're not going to ask for a chargeback against yourself. So you inflate the denominator of the transactions, and Visa or MasterCard is only looking really at the ratio. They're not necessarily as concerned about the absolute number of chargebacks. So the more you can inflate the transaction volumes, the easier it is to avoid the risks and penalties associated with chargebacks. And one way to do it would be through the use of prepaid cards. But in another vein, prepaid cards are also a well-documented way to launder money just by ease. They don't even need to be a physical card, but you can also very easily move them across borders. And there's, again, very limited know-your-customer procedures around prepaid cards. And that's largely going to be those procedures and compliance protocols will be established by the issuing bank. So Wirecard has full control over the situation. So you can imagine how not only can these cards be used to help with the risks associated with chargebacks, but they can also launder vast sums of money.
All right. And you took those findings to the agencies or regulators. Did I get that right?
We don't really talk about what the methods are. We only go and find evidence, and that helps us build conviction in our short position.
Okay. At that point, were you certain that there was something wrong, even if you wouldn't fully understand what was happening behind the these large buildings of Wirecard?
So the thing is, I'm a short seller. I'm not a prosecutor. I think sometimes we get so caught up in, you know, do I have the clear-cut evidence that will put these people in prison? If I did, then I wouldn't be doing this. I don't have subpoena power. I'm limited in how much I can prove on my own, right? The best I can do is collect as much evidence as possible and draw reasonable conclusions based on that evidence. So, it's always about collecting more information and data points so that we can have greater conviction. A short seller can never really prove it on their own, simply because, you know, we don't have access to the material non-public information that would likely be the final nail in the coffin, so to speak.
Basically, what you do is work with the information that is out there that is public, but you basically analyze it better or more thoroughly than anybody else.
Yeah, and you would be surprised how many public sources of information are out there. I'm not sure how many investors actually went to Citi North American prepaid card headquarters, which were then Wirecard US headquarters, to actually learn about these prepaid cards. I'm not sure how many of them were tracking all of these business decisions and looking at that in the perspective of changes in anti-money laundering over the throughout the globe, specifically relating to U.S. sanctions, Magnitsky Act, and terror financing issues. So it's about being as creative as possible as finding the right public sources of information, but also putting all of that information in the appropriate context.
Mm-hmm. I think to many outside of the financial world, short selling is kind of hard to understand. Can you explain, like, very simple terms, what you do, what your daily business is?
Well, short selling is just a trading strategy, and most participants in the market will engage in short selling to some extent because it's a way of hedging. But you're effectively betting that the price of a stock or security will decline. And the way it's technically done is you go to your bank, your broker, you borrow shares from them, you sell those on the open market. At some point, you will have to give those shares back to your broker. So the hope is you can buy those shares back at a lower price than where you borrowed them so you can make a profit. It is your upside shorting is capped, whereas your risk, your downside is unlimited. So it's a very risky strategy. And it's generally part of a much broader set of market strategies. However, we do it exclusively.
What is the motivation behind it? I think many people know you because of the Netflix documentary where you were pursuing Valeant, the pharmaceutical company. And with it, there was, I think, involved a motivation that went beyond financial motives because you were trying to protect patients that were ripped off by this company. Is there a general underlying motivation for you?
Yeah, I would say that I wouldn't be in this industry if it weren't for very specifically what I'm doing. I am not so much interested in being a money manager and being an investor. I'm interested in making money through this very specific way of identifying fraudulent criminal behaviors in publicly traded companies. That's specifically what I'm interested in. That's what motivates me. My job is, of course, to make a profit for my investors. But the only thing that really interests me about that whole process is the fact there's some way to perhaps see some justice. So, you know, I think some people may find that a little bit disingenuous, but if you ever spent a day in my shoes, you would realize that the stress, the issues that we have to deal with, the difficulty of executing on a strategy like this, particularly in this sort of market environment, most people would probably not think it's worth it. So for me, it's worth it because of the justice component.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you mentioned yourself that there have been allegations against Wirecard for at least 20 years, so basically since the company has been around. What is your explanation, or what was your explanation? Why didn't it stop the company from growing, from having a higher share price?
Well, the thing is, acquisitions are really tricky, and fraudulent businesses can keep that fraud under wraps for a very long time as long as they're able to continuously grow the business through acquisitions. So as a short seller, you know, one thing we do like to see are roll-ups because first of all, just on a fundamental level, a lot of these businesses that are engaged in rapid acquisitions generally don't have organic growth within their core business. So they will reach for acquisitions to, you know, have inflated inorganic growth. But on top of that, if you're using some sort of fraudulent method or you're engaged in some amount of crime, it's a lot easier to cover that up the bigger you get. And that really was the case with Wirecard. So for a short seller, the timing is absolutely critical. And you mentioned Valeant. Things really started to fall apart for Valeant after they had acquired Salix Pharmaceuticals, which was their largest acquisition, really. And after that, it became much more difficult to access capital markets, and their acquisition strategy was coming to an end. Same thing with Wirecard. They had acquired the Citi North American prepaid card business, and suddenly it seemed that the acquisitions really had slowed down or come to an end completely. So that's the point where things start to get interesting and the company becomes much more vulnerable to having the fraud exposed. So, you know, just as important as it is to identify the underlying fraudulent activity within a company, as a short seller, if you're looking for financial gain, it's even more important to identify at what point in time is that fraud possibly going to become, you know, a business-ending risk for the company.
Mm-hmm. Yet from the point where you started shorting the stock to the point where the company basically broke down, it took some time and was I think, kind of a rocky way for you as well. I mean, I think back at February 2019, when BaFin, the German regulatory authority, essentially banned all new short sale on Wirecard. Do you remember that? What was your initial reaction?
Anger, honestly. I had no intention of going public with the position of Wirecard or short in Wirecard at that point in time. I felt my hand was forced by the actions BaFin took, because it's very easy to paint a conspiracy theory when you have a lot of anonymous actors. So I felt that it would be important for there to be a face to the hedge funds that short Wirecard. And that's why I decided to write the letter to BaFin to educate them on our role in the markets, but also say, you know, we're real, we're here, and we're short Wirecard. And there's, you can't put us as part of any sort of conspiracy.
You wrote the letter like four weeks after, I think. Did you really think you could change their mind? Or what was your objective by writing a letter to BaFin?
Well, there was the question of whether or not they would extend the ban, because there was still significant volatility in the stock, and the reasoning for instituting the ban in the first place was very unclear. But it was more just to put them on notice, because it's not as though the saga began or ended with the BaFin short selling ban. It was only a piece of everything that was going on as far as the regulators' willful blindness and what we're finding out now, likely their complicity in some of this criminal activity at Wirecard. So they couldn't say that we didn't know any better. So it just felt important for me to be on the record as someone who does believe in the value of short selling, regardless of whether or not it changed any minds at BaFin.
Mm-hmm. So when I checked the archives for my preparation, I saw that shortly thereafter, we had this report claiming to clear Wirecard from all the existing accusations. And I saw that, for instance, Business Insider ran a rather nasty headline than Pharmacardia just got smoked short selling Wirecard. How do you cope with stuff like that? I mean, it doesn't feel like a smooth
I wasn't even aware of the article.
Oh, really?
so the thing is, you know, I think while people know that I'm short, they also have no idea what my underlying, you know, investment activity actually looks like. And small moves or even big moves over a short period of time, if that was enough to spook me, then I wouldn't be able to do what I do. We actually made a profit shorting Wirecard in 2019. So, you know, I don't recall ever being smoked. The thing is, if we didn't do the type of work we do and go as deep as we do and collect as much information as we do around these shorts, then maybe I would feel worried when the stock would move against me and BaFin puts in the short selling ban, etc. But no, you know, I sleep very soundly at night knowing that we're right. Or we have pretty good certainty around the information we have, the position we have. And therefore, the short-term volatility isn't enough to make me feel concerned.
Mm-hmm. Die Werbung.
Wir machen eine kurze Unterbrechung für unseren Werbepartner Liquid. Viele von euch werden es kennen, das Streben nach Selbstoptimierung und dem ständigen Drang, sich weiterzuentwickeln. Die hohen Anforderungen an sich selbst übertragen sich auch oft auf andere Bereiche des Lebens. Umso spannender ist es, dass viele erfolgreiche Menschen nicht denselben Anspruch bei ihren Finanzen entwickeln. Wer aber kein Anlageprodukt von der Stange, sondern hochwertige, maßgeschneiderte Anlagelösungen und einen persönlichen Ansprechpartner sucht, sollte einmal bei Liquid vorbeischauen. Liquid ist ein moderner Vermögensverwalter auf Family Office Niveau. Spezialisiert darauf, Anlegern einen exklusiven Zugang zu Anlagelösungen zu bieten, die bisher nur Großanlegern zur Verfügung standen. Mit Liquid erhaltet ihr nicht nur Zugang zu erstklassigem Wealth Management, sondern auch zu den weltweit führenden Venture Capital und Private Equity Fonds. Wer sich jetzt eben ertappt gefühlt hat und seine Finanzen weiterentwickeln möchte, bekommt hier seinen Reminder, sich einen Moment Zeit zu nehmen. Alle Infos und ein erstes persönliches Gespräch bekommt ihr auf www.liquid.de/FFWD.
Werbung Ende.
Did the Wirecard experience change your view on Germany? I think a lot of people have like an image of an orderly country with a functioning rule of law, maybe even less excess of capitalism that you would expect rather in the States or something.
Well, I'm not sure if it necessarily changed my perception, simply because the scandal we see with Wirecard is a story that seems to repeat itself within Germany. You have large financial institutions that are German that consistently get dragged in to major money laundering scandals. And it's generally never the German regulatory establishment that picks up on it first. So I don't think it's unusual. I think this is the status quo for Germany. I think it is a very orderly country in many ways, and you have great people in Germany. But for some reason, perhaps, you know, geopolitical concerns, there always seems to be this issue of money laundering, particularly as the U.S. has really clamped down on, you know, Russian sanctions and Iran sanctions. It seems like Germany's is always on the other side of U.S. prosecutors. So it's not, to me, it's not necessarily surprising, but if I was a German, I would just be disappointed that we continue to have these problems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In the case of Wirecard, who's responsible on the side of the regulators or on the side of the board? Anybody who'd made anything right?
Who isn't? That's the thing. I think when the dust settles, we'll find that you know people will probably be surprised by who aided and abetted in this situation, because you have folks like Eichelman who come onto the board, but it is during that period that the KPMG investigation was basically being obstructed, that a lot of this was being covered up, so. There's pie on a lot of people's faces here. And I'm not, I wish I was a fly on the wall so I could know exactly what was going on. But I'm sure as time goes on and more pressure is being put on BaFin, we'll learn what the real story is here. But it's, to me, what's more disappointing is how many people actually covered it up. I'm not saying they were all fully aware of the criminal activity or even knew the extent of it, but they were actively covering up bad behavior, and that makes you complicit in the crime.
Whom do you include in this group?
Like I said, I don't know who you can't include in it.
What role did the press play? I mean, a lot of the critical investigations came from the FT, where you'd say Wirecard isn't necessarily a core business to watch.
Yeah, I can't even have enough words as far as what Dan McCrum has done here and the battle he waged and the diligence at which he pursued Wirecard. It's absolutely incredible, and it's just a masterclass in journalism. But that isn't to say German journalists also didn't investigate Wirecard. Melanie Bergerman at WeWo, she was always on this story and very critical of Wirecard for a long period. But, you know, retrospectively, you know, given what I've experienced and what I've seen and knowing what this company is capable of, you know, it takes a certain amount of willingness to take on risk to be able to report critically on Wirecard. It's a very dangerous company. The resources that it has access to in some ways are bottomless. You have Jan Marslik under protection of the Russian GRU. All of this, it's very terrifying. And I understand why certain people may not have wanted to dive in and be critical of this company, because you're taking on a mortal risk. And not everyone is necessarily suited for that. But that said, journalists, you know, Dan McCrum, to the few in Germany, did play an essential role in continuing to put pressure on this company and, you know, basically taking on all of that risk so that we could all have access to the truth.
The idea that Wirecard is really a physically dangerous company, is that something that you experienced while researching the company, or something that you only realized with the benefit of hindsight after all these revelations?
It is unfortunately something I've experienced firsthand, and also just given, you know, diving into the ecosystem that Wirecard operates in, also knowing what they've done to others, you know, whistleblowers and those that have even worked within Wirecard. It was always a concern for me, and it is something, unfortunately, I've had to experience.
Can you give examples for that?
One day. I don't think the dust is still settling, so I'm not prepared to relive all of that just yet.
Okay. You talked about the role of timing that is very important for a short seller. In your view, with your explanation, what made Wirecard tumble in the end? Was it in any way predictable that there would be a tipping point in you know, spring or summer of 2020?
You have to take a few steps back and first go back to what I was saying as far as the acquisition strategy was coming to an end. And we saw their desperation for capital through the debt raises in 2019. So we knew that on a fundamental level, the company was perhaps ready to break. And then add to that, you finally have internal whistleblowers coming forward and providing information to the FT. Again, this was something that we hadn't seen before. So in many ways, the company was more vulnerable than it's ever been. And what short sellers might say, this is when we get to be playing offense and the company has to play defense. So they're in a defensive position, dealing with issues on all fronts, whether it's their shareholders, you have journalists, you have whistleblowers. So suddenly this is all going on at once. What finally did it, it's hard to say. Obviously, the price itself started to stagnate once it was included on the DAX. So again, once you have apply more scrutiny, you have fundamental pressure, you can't acquire more businesses, that all causes problems. But what we also saw at the end of 2017 and through 2018 is that there was a restructuring of some of these third-party businesses that Wirecard was associated with. And we saw certain individuals pulling themselves out, resigning from certain entities. So it seems like they were in some ways unwinding parts of the business. Again, that tells us that perhaps they see the end coming, perhaps more they saw the end coming likely before the markets did. And part of this also was likely Marcus Braun's margin loan that he took the end of 2017. So I would say this whole unraveling began in 2017. Mm-hmm. And nothing, it never happened so quickly. It doesn't happen overnight. This was in the makes for the past almost 3 years. But when we get to 2020, what many may not realize, and perhaps because it's not necessarily being reported on in Germany, but March 9th, the U.S. Southern District of New York indicted an individual, arrested him, and he's tied to the Wirecard scheme. And 3 days after that indictment, Wirecard announced that it would be delaying the KPMG report. So, you know, you could also perhaps see how the U.S. prosecutors are getting involved, and that is then causing sloppiness on Wirecard's part because now they have something else to worry about. And now actors within their network are being arrested. So there really wasn't anywhere to hide. So it's really from that point, from March 9th, you know, things truly unraveled in a way that was unstoppable.
Does a short seller feel some kind of satisfaction at one point?
You know, I haven't felt it yet. For me, the satisfaction isn't the chase. It isn't putting the pieces of information together. It's those breakthrough moments where you have this epiphany, like, oh my gosh, this is what's going on, and I can prove it. Those are the moments that really get me excited as a short seller. So in some ways, I miss all of that. I miss the intrigue of investigating Wirecard to that extent. But I still also feel as though there's not yet closure in the Wirecard saga for myself and for many other individuals who are affected by the company, simply because to this day, the German establishment is really trying to dismiss this story and say it's just accounting fraud, you know, the executives took advantage, et cetera, while brushing under the rug the much more severe accusations around money laundering. My hope is that with global regulatory interest here, you know, U.S. prosecutors also potentially looking at all of this, I think, you know, one day we'll get proper justice here. So I hope that the pressure is maintained and we continue to see more of the truth be revealed.
Mm-hmm. You said that the dust is still settling in. In your view, so Wirecard is more than or should, in your view, be more than just accounting fraud. What was it? Was it like a giant money laundering machine?
Yeah, it's a giant digital laundromat. That's what we believe it is. And the thing about that is, you know, if you cut off this specific laundromat, where does this volume of money then get laundered through? So for us, it hasn't ended. You know, once you open the Pandora's box of money laundering and organized crime, you got to keep digging. So these guys, they've already, you know, we believe they found other outlets. So we'll find them.
Okay. And in the case of Wirecard, do you still have a short position or is all of that closed?
We have a small short position left, yes. So, I would say it's like a token short position.
But reflecting your idea that there still is way to go.
Yeah, we took significant profit, obviously. From June 18th for the next following week, we continued to short more. And then, you know, I would say probably a week and a half after the whole saga ended and, you know, Wirecard was down to €2, we took most of the profits because, again, at the end of the day, I'm a money manager. So I need to be able to tell my investors we've taken a profit where it makes sense. But we still do have a tiny position left.
Are you telling how much money it made you?
No.
Okay.
But it was the biggest winner we've ever had.
All right. Fahmi, thanks a lot for the talk. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.